This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Have a drink on us. That was the response from Amel and the Sniffers to the last-minute cancellation of their free gig at Federation Square on Friday.
So what we're doing is using our fee to go back to some local venues. So we put Have a Drink on Us in ACDC fashion. 5K at the bar at Last Chance, The Tote, Labour and Vane, Hell's Kitchen, The Curtain, Cherry Bar and Old Bar. So there's $5,000 tab on each of those venues at the bar. So Have a Drink on Us. We're so sorry, we really wanted to play. I was chucking a tantrum like, no, tomorrow, you can't imagine it. And so sorry, just have some fun tonight.
So did Amel and the Sniffers inject more money in support to small live music venues with the $5,000 that they put onto the bars? Did they help those music venues more than any government grant or lack thereof, especially during COVID? The venues who did receive the bar tabs have said they felt supported and seen for the first time in a long time. So were you at one of the bars? What was the reaction? What was the vibe to this support? We'll speak to a man who just so happened to know where all of the bars were, grabbed his camera and visited all of them in just a moment. And also this hour, as you've been hearing, Victoria Police have said that PSOs, so Protective Services Officers, they will now have a bit of a shake-up, and how they're used, it will be different. So do you see PSOs when and where you travel, and do they make you feel safer?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
You know, the security and the support, and the security and the police officers weren't given the support by Fed Square. You know, the planning wasn't there to keep people safe. You know, people did the wrong thing jumping the barriers, but the organisers, Fed Square, you know, Amel, one of the biggest bands in the world right now. They're supporting ACDC. It's not the first event they put on there for free. We're obviously upset that they cancel it, but we understand they shut it down because of safety. You know, I've been in massive crowds at festivals where people have been hurt, and I understand they shut it down for those reasons. It's just unfortunate that they weren't, you know, more prepared.
So could they have been more prepared? That's Jack, who called Raphael Epstein this morning. But from that cancellation, Amel and the Sniffers took their fee and gave it to small live music venues. And the response has been incredible from the venues, from the musos, and from the punters. Were you there? A man who knew where all of the venues were and grabbed his camera. A warm welcome back to the studio, Jeremy Story, Cardinal ABC Communities reporter.
G'day, Rich.
I just happened to know where all those pubs were, my friend.
Yeah, this is what years of research gets you. And particularly where those pubs are at after 10 at night. It wasn't what I had planned for my night, but it turned out to be a pretty special one.
Ryan Egan from Double J. Ryan, we spoke on Friday. Of course, Double J were presenting this gig. We knew it was going to be big. Amel and the Sniffers knew it was going to be big. Did anyone expect it to be quite this big?
I didn't think we'd reach capacity quite that early, and that's, it was a bit of a surprise to me. I think, I don't know the exact time, but it felt like it was around sort of 7:40-ish, or maybe a tiny bit later during Public Figures set, which was really brilliant, great local band performing live. The Bagpipers managed to get up towards the stage as well, and then they cancelled the event after the breaches. I was near the Riverside, where that gate was, and the stairs that were going up there when that broke through as well. It was pretty scary. I figured it would probably get to capacity. I just didn't think it'd get there quite that early.
So Katrina Sedgwick, who's the CEO of the Melbourne Arts Precinct Corporation, which manages Federation Square, she spoke with Raphael Epstein this morning.
We had a very well-planned event with a detailed risk assessment, with appropriate security, appropriate fencing. But when crowd behaviour got out of control and literally were tearing down fences and pouring into a full venue, clearly marked full venue that had already been closed for 40 minutes in their hundreds, we did the right thing, which was to say, this is not safe, and we shut it down.
Amel and the Sniffers have also said that this was the right thing to do. Was it, I mean, now as people are people just trying to point the finger, find someone to blame? I mean, there's been a big momentum, Ryan, building up to this gig. We spoke on Friday about the energy that's in the city at the moment. All of the gigs, whether it be AC/DC, Oasis, Metallica, Amel and Sniffers, you name it. Was anyone actually to blame, or was this just boiling point?
I mean, it's tricky when you've got thousands of people trying to get into a venue, which what it felt like to me. I reckon there was at least 400 or 500 coming through the gate that I was at. And so you've got spaces that are set up for a certain amount of people. You've got security in place to make sure that people who are in the venue are safe. And you've got, as Katrina said, you know, your risk assessments, you've got your systems in place. And if something's full, I mean, you kind of have to call it. I mean, there was a lot of families, a lot of little kids at the front of the stage. A lot of those people were trying to get out once it was actually cancelled as well, and were finding it really difficult to leave. And I think if something terrible had happened on Monday morning, we'd all be having a very different conversation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're going to talk about all of the venues that benefited from the $5,000 bar tab and how that has injected some energy back into Melbourne's small live music scene. But Jeremy Story-Carter, a text came in earlier saying, is Federation Square even the right place to be holding live gigs?
It absolutely is. I think it has actually been one of the underreported, like, brilliant things going on in the city at the moment. So on grand final eve, right, a couple of months back, I went from watching Greg Champion from the Quarterbean Champions, seeing That's a Thing About Football in a local pub in Fitzroy, got on a tram, went down Fed Square, Eddie Current Suppression Ring, playing to a packed out venue. It like a truly, truly joyous night. Very, very successful. Obviously didn't make the news in widely because it was just
nothing
a great
bad
gig.
Happened.
Nothing bad happened. Equally, a couple of weeks ago, a band called King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard played this sort of rave set. Again, completely packed out, well-behaved crowd. That was live streamed around the world. And on YouTube, I was at home, admittedly, with my one-year-old daughter. Wasn't there, but I was watching it on YouTube. And people from all over the world, particularly in the US and Canada, were saying, what an amazing thing. I wish I was in Melbourne. This is great. Of course, there should be a discussion about the technical aspects of security. And I think some of us aren't necessarily qualified to have those discussions. But as a contribution and maybe as a realizing what Fed Square can be, I think it's brilliant. I think an all ages, alcohol free environment where people can watch live music and we can celebrate what apparently we love celebrating in this city, which is our live music culture. I think it's really special. So get it right for sure, but don't write it off.
Are you worried, Ryan, that now maybe Fed Square will think twice about putting gigs on like this? Because forever, right, we've debated, oh, Fed Square, what's its point? It's ugly. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And of late, it's been really coming to the party, quite literally. Will they think twice about putting on big gigs like this?
And it's hard to speculate on what they'll do. They've got gigs already lined up. So they've got a gig on Thursday the 27th of November with some DJs. I'm sure that'll be a lot of fun. There's always sporting things on there on the screen as well. So lots of crowds come in to watch the sport in that space. And if, you know, as Jeremy said as well, there's been some great gigs recently that have been free and have run really well. And we want to use these spaces in our city. We don't want them just to be sitting there idly doing nothing. They're set up to be used in that way. There's a brand new train station being built in that area as well. And if it's done properly and it's done safely and no one gets hurt and bands have a great time and punters have a really good time, I think that's really good. It's one part of the Melbourne live music experience. It's not the be all and end all, but it would be a shame if they stopped, and I don't think they will. They'll just probably have a little bit of a look at, you know, what we do next, how do we manage this a bit differently, and who might we book that maybe fits the square a little bit better.
And those who then couldn't get into that gig and once it was cancelled did start to bar hop to the venues that received the $5,000 from Amel and the Sniffers. Jeremy Story-Carter is with you, Ryan Egan from Double J. Peter's in North Melbourne. G'day, Peter.
Oh, hi, Rochelle.
You were there?
Yeah, our 16-year-old son and his best mate were about three rows from the front of the stage. And Fiona, his mum, and I were a bit further back. It was a really great night. There was no sense of aggro that we could really detect. I really think there's an element of exaggeration going on about the crowd trying to get in. We really didn't see any of that. I think it was just really badly handled. And I think they took a real risk cancelling it, because I think they ran the risk of the crowd turning really ugly, because it was so badly communicated. They flashed up the big sign saying, we're pausing the event. And we just thought, oh, there's a technical issue. And then all of a sudden, there's the banners, the big signs just said, event cancelled. Mm. And, you know, Nick Reese, who was there at the start of the night, proclaiming how fabulous it was that bands like Amel and the Sniffers were there, bigging himself up, and then he's nowhere to be seen. The stage is empty, and he's nowhere to be seen when he's most needed to calm the crowd and explain exactly what's going on.
Good to get your thoughts on this, Peter, because there's lots of texts coming in saying things like this. You know, I was in the city on Friday night for dinner. Even though the gig was cancelled, the city was filled to the brim with people pouring out of the restaurants and bars. Report on some of the good things that happen in Melbourne for a change. Well, I guess we are trying to actually shine a spotlight on the great work that Federation Square have been doing to have all ages and free gigs. But then from that, people did spill out into the suburbs and into those smaller venues, because the fee that Amel and the Sniffers were due to receive, they took that money and they gave it to venues like the Old Bar, the Tote, the Curtain, Labour and Vane, Hell's Kitchen, I think Last Chance, Rock and Roll Bar, Cherry Bar. It created such an energy. Jeremy Story Carter, you heard that news, you grabbed your camera and you just so happened to know where all of the venues were, my friend. So all of that work you've been doing over the years came home to roost. People have been talking about, and venue owners in particular, have been talking about this is the most support that they've received in years. Did it feel like that?
It certainly, there are sometimes you walk in a room and no one needs to tell you what's going on. Like there's an electricity, there's an energy. And it was like that on Friday night. There's just something you can't, and this is why I love live music spaces so much. Like you just can't quite describe it, but something's pinging around in the room. There's just people are chatting in a way that feels fun and positive. I even was chatting with some bouncers out the front of the curtain, and there was a line down, and actually the bar tab had run out at that point.
I'm sure it didn't last very long.
It didn't actually. It didn't last very long at the curtain. I was chatting to the bouncer, and he was just like, "You cannot imagine how like." Not just well behaved, but which is always the case with Melbourne's live music scene, but like really positive the whole place was. It actually really wasn't about the free drinks at all. It was this sense that a band like Amel and the Sniffers, who frankly do not exist without the live music venues that we have in this city, and they recognise that. They're very aware of where they are now, but where they've come from. And so the fact that they were spotlighting those venues, not just with the money, but kind of trying to direct the attention back towards them, I think that was quietly very significant.
Did you feel that as well, Ryan, that they hadn't forgotten? Yes, they are the biggest, one of the biggest bands in the world right now. They're touring, Grammys, you name it.
Yep.
However, they're like, without these venues, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I think it was an amazing feeling to turn something around that was a pretty tough situation and make it so positive. I think, hats off to them. We named them on Double J as our Australian Artist of the Year last week. And when they put that message out and when I heard that's what was happening, I was like, that's why they're Australian Artist of the Year for us. That's what you want. That's what you want to see happen from artists. And, it's a shame that some of these venues really struggling and an injection like this, which is not much.
Well, that's what caught me.
It makes such a massive difference.
Like, that's 5K really shocking, meant I think. So much. That is shocking.
Yeah.
And I think it is one of those things where both things can be true. So yes. I'm reluctant to kind of, I continue to say the Fed Square gigs are great. Again, let's get them right. But I think what a lot of these venues would say is that they are really, really struggling. There is an intersection of costs that they are sort of falling behind on, and they need help. And so this money is, it's real, but it's also symbolic. And what I think the slightly bittersweet element of it was that there seems like there's a willingness to support gigs and bands at a certain threshold when they get to a certain size, and everyone can kind of agree that this is something. Mm. And, you know, you see money put behind festivals and certain types of live music sort of shows, but the venues that main those things even exist in the first place, those are the ones that are really struggling
to keep their doors
and
open.
Feel like they're not necessarily seeing that sort of money, and they're not asking for We're talking things like the rising insurance costs. We're talking things like regulatory imposts that aren't very sexy and don't make for a good photo shoot, but they're looking to get on the phone with policymakers and people who can actually help navigate them through that process. That's where they feel like they're not being heard. And that's before you get to the fact that we've got a very changing economy where people are going out a bit less. If they are out, they're spending less, they're drinking less, which is not such a bad thing. But there are lots of issues that these venues are confronting and they just don't feel that support's there.
Meg's in South Bank. Hi, Meg.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you, speaker.
What do you want to say?
Oh, I live locally and I was out for my usual walk that evening and gone through the gardens, saw all the crowd going to Sam Fender and then could hear Federation Square. I'm like, so I made my way towards there to see. It was already fenced off, but it was watching people just constantly go from entrance to entrance to try and get in with there being no direction from the security or anything that unfortunately you're not going to get in, but they just kept trying everywhere around, and it sort of had that heightened potential problem about it from the crowd outside. And there are many people were walking around drinking alcohol and things like that, where you sort of think
something's going to go pear-shaped. Yeah,
you could see it. You could see it from a distance. And I thought, well, I definitely don't want to be anywhere near here. So,
did it feel like that maybe there was just there needed to be more security? So not that there was a lack of security, Ryan, but like Meg was saying, people trying to go here. I saw some footage of one security guard where there were people trying to jump fences and he was literally just standing there going, what is one man going to do?
Look, I mean, from where I was standing, there seemed to be enough security to keep things under control, but also you don't know what a crowd's going to do. It's very unpredictable. There were a lot of people outside. Yeah. And I would imagine Federation Square are going to be looking at their security and looking at this situation, debriefing this week on those things. But, you know, I didn't know until afterwards that there were other breaches on the other side. So from where I was, like, well, there's a lot of people come in here. It's probably going to be a bit of a problem. Didn't realise that there were another two or three locations. And then if you get into the nighttime, you get where people can't see each other. And it gets even
and
more then, people outside.
Right. And,
you
just don't, and there's alcohol involved.
It's
and
really
aggression.
Tricky, you know. I think Fed Square will be looking at this stuff, but it's hard for me to tell whether. Yeah,
I would hate for the takeaway from this whole thing to be, oh, we've really got to crack down on these sorts of things. There is a real risk of hyperbole. I think ultimately, if the venue felt that it couldn't be safe, and if the band has subsequently kind of reflected on that too, if people couldn't be safe, then this was the right call to make. Yep, we can have a chat about how to fix this. Maybe a band like that is unfortunately just too big. But I do think that we can't always just dip into live music when something's on fire. You know, and I do, like, we like the idea that it's there, but we don't sort of tend to it. And it's sort of uncontroversial to come out and say, like, oh, we're going to bail out of, I don't know, an aluminium smelter in regional New South Wales or, you know, put money. But these are places that employ lots and lots of people. They contribute billions to the economy, literally billions. But we don't sort of view them in those terms. And because they have a sort of economy that looks a little bit different, it does involve alcohol, it does involve nighttime. Somehow we think of it as this kind of tawdry
thing.
Do you
know what I'm actually really happy about is, you know, we've been talking, and Ryan, you and I were talking on Friday about just the pure energy that rock and roll has got in this city over the last, not even a couple of weeks, but maybe the last month. Melbourne has really come alive and is celebrating its musical roots and its rock and roll roots. What I love about the unfortunate thing that happened on Friday night is that somehow that passion and that energy ended up back in the small live music venues where it belongs. I'm not saying don't put it on the MCG, don't put it on at Federation Square. But as Jeremy said, the only reason why those gigs exist is because of the old bar, because of Cherry, because of the Tote, because of all of those small venues. And somehow amongst all of this chaos, those names are in the headlines. They received a little bit of money. They received a little bit of momentum. And it kind of ended up back where it should be.
Yeah, and there's live music venues and small venues across the state and, you know, across the city as well. A lot of these are concentrated around Melbourne, the inner north and other places. But there's, you know, wherever you're listening now, there's probably some live music happening this weekend. you know, and we talked about this on Friday 100%. Too, you know, if you're energized by this and you've been out to see AC/DC last night like I did, maybe, you know, like use that energy to put back into, you know, a venue near you, even if you're just going a little bit, a few more times, you know, if you bring in a couple of extra mates, if you're doing something like that, that makes a difference. Obviously, there's things that can be done potentially by governments and others and peak bodies, but, you know, punters as
momentum.
Well. You know, take that momentum and run with it. You know, we are really lucky in this city. We've nurtured and grown huge artists. The next band that is going to be, you know, topping festivals around the country is perhaps playing this Friday night. You might like to go and check them out.
Yeah. And was it nice to get out and about, Jeremy, given that you've got a one-year-old bub? Was it nice to stomp in the old hood?
It was a lovely evening.
Oh, you buried the lead there. I didn't realise. That's the real reason for getting out of the house, wasn't it?
It was purely professional, but it was nice to see some old faces too. No, I do get out actually still to a lot of live music, and I completely echo. Like I this has actually been one of the best years for gigs I've had in Melbourne. Honestly, I think there's been such amazing programming around town. That doesn't mean venues aren't struggling. And one of the things I do like about the Fed Square thing is the all ages aspect.
Yeah.
Because a lot of venues will tell you that after the pandemic, a generation kind of maybe missed out on that thing of going to live music venues in their early 20s. They're sort of missing a generation. So to have Fed Square be introducing these sorts of bands to 15, 16, 17-year-olds and be like, oh, cool, when I'm older, I want to go see them in my neighbourhood. That's really cool. I think we've got to keep doing that.
Well, people can check out your story, all of the venues and the punters and the publicans that you spoke with on the ABC's website. Jeremy Story Carter, ABC Communities reporter. Ryan Egan from Double J. You're faring quite well, mate, considering you went to AC/DC last night.
I have to say I came early for Emily and the Sniffers
baby.
And I stayed very late for AC/DC and I had a really good time. And, you know, like if you can get yourself interstate and get a ticket, go and check them out.
Good on you, Ryan Egan from Double J. Coming up in just a moment, there will be some changes to how PSOs are used, where they're placed, everywhere from the stations they may or may not be at, or even the shopping centres that they may be at. So how would you like to see PSOs deployed?
The ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Still plenty of calls and texts coming in on live music venues and how we can support them. We'll get back to more of those in just a moment. But as you may have been hearing with Raf this morning, how PSOs, so protective service officers, how they'll be used and where they'll be placed will change. But we've actually had PSOs now since 2012. And back when they were originally introduced, they were there to improve the safety of train travel, especially after dark, to try and reduce crime and antisocial behaviour. It all sounds very familiar, doesn't it? But is it now time for a shake-up of how they're used and where they're used? I mean, do you even see PSOs when you're on public transport? And if you do, do they make you feel safer? Do they allow you to travel, especially at night? So this is Chief Commissioner of Police Mike Bush. He explained over the weekend what the changes are and how it may impact either your local station or even your local shopping centre.
We are going to be able to, in the early new year, to deploy our PSOs, our Protective Service Officers, in a more active, mobile, flexible, intelligent way. Current situation with our PSOs is that they are cemented to the 220-odd stations we have across Greater Melbourne. What we need to do is deploy them in a more intelligent way, depending on demand and where they really, really need to be. So when that commences, 32 stations will have all day and all night until last train coverage on stations. Another 72 will, as they do at the moment, have permanent officers from 6 p.m. till last train. The other 120, very low demand, very low crime rates, will then be serviced by what we call clusters of PSOs. Each cluster will cover off 6 stations. And what they will be allowed to do now with the changes is that they will be able to move around those stations, they will be able to travel on the network, and they will actually be able to patrol in shopping areas immediately adjacent to those stations. That will give us a far more intelligent, far more effective way of preventing crime and keeping people across that network safe.
Do you see PSOs at the moment when you travel? Does it determine whether or not you actually travel, especially at night? This text, with PSOs being sent to shopping centres, will there be enough PSOs to keep our train stations safe? Dr. Lauren Pearson is a transport researcher at Monash University. Lauren, is this a better way to use PSOs to take them out of areas maybe where they're not as highly needed, turn them into clusters that are mobile? Is this a good progression, do you think?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Rochelle. And I think this is such a nuanced issue because we're balancing different kinds of safety concerns with quite limited resources. But we've kind of got two things that we're looking at here. So we have to remember that PSOs are really important, not only for, you know, reducing their kind of crime, reducing actual crime, but they also play this really invisible role for many people, but particularly for women, in terms of enhancing how safe they feel on a public transport network. And that kind of role, even if it just means that, you know, we've got PSOs often kind of just standing there chatting in that kind of way at the station that we often see, that's really essential for people who use public transport, not just as a, you know, a convenience, but more so as a lifeline. This is how a lot of people get to work, to get to TAFE, to get to uni, to essential services. And we know that women who are most vulnerable to harassment are the biggest users of public transport as well.
So this, the idea of the clusters that they'll move in and around, I think around six stations, in and off different forms of public transport, maybe even move to places like shopping centres. So that will mean that there will be quite a lot of stations that won't have anybody at them at any given time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And what I thought was interesting about this, so my research has found that particularly public transport is really critical for young women in particular. Many of them work in kind of shift work type roles, so thinking hospitality, healthcare, and often living in your kind of outer urban suburbs as well. So they're not only travelling well outside of daylight hours, but they're often using these stations which are, you would say, off-peak. I would say they're kind of not so busy, not as busy as kind of our inner city areas. And in Melbourne, we've got our kind of highest frequency between 7 a.m. 7 p.m. Mm. And outside of that, those services only really run about kind of once an hour, if they run at all. So we get a lot of these women who are either, you know, thinking, okay, instead of taking public transport, I'm going to drive, but then I know I'm going to have to pay for parking, etc., yeah. Or I'm going to pay for rideshare. Or if they're not in that position, they are left between, kind of have they had this choice between, you know, giving up a shift at work or having to wait at a station for long periods of time. And what I've noticed with this media release in terms of these 120 low-risk stations that will have these reduced PSOs is that that really does kind of miss this invisible role that these PSOs play at these stations for these women.
Absolutely. And don't get me started on being a woman and driving and parking in some of those high-rise car parks overnight. Absolutely terrifying. And one of the ramps was closed and they said, oh, use the stairwell. I'm like, that was so not written by a woman. There's no way I'm taking that stairwell at 11 o'clock at night, you know, all dolled up on my own. Dr. Lauren Pearson is with you, transport researcher at Monash University. This text, yes, I went to the ballet one night recently by myself. I'm a senior. The PSO at the Essendon station kindly offered to walk me to my car on my return, as he could see that I was nervous, as I don't travel on the train usually. Is that common practice to have a PSO walk somebody to their car? That's incredible.
I know, isn't it fantastic? Yeah, and again, these are the kind of invisible roles that we often don't see kind of taken on board when these kind of decisions are made, because we don't often measure things like how safe people feel, and that doesn't really play into our decision making quite as much as reports of actual crime. And we know that harassment, particularly gendered harassment, is extremely underreported, and that means that that's not really being taken into account within these decisions.
Tiff's in Geelong. Morning.
Hi, how are you?
Really well. What do you want to say?
I just wanted to say I do not have any problem really with PSOs being utilised however they need to be. I was concerned about the prevalence of people seeking money from passengers on the train. It's an environment in which you're trapped. I'm more than happy to give people money who need some spare cash, but I find that the experience of a female family member, it's really ramping up.
Mm.
They're quite aggressive. And
do you feel safe on the trains, Tiff?
Actually hit in the head by one of the boys who were seeking money, even though she said, "I'm so sorry, I don't have any cash." So for me, at night, no, I don't feel safe on the train. And even one of my sons won't take the train anymore because he's exceptionally shy. Yeah, I worry about our safety on the trains as well as on platforms. I'd love to see some more visibility on the trains.
Yeah, there's nothing like sort of doing a quick recce when you walk on and your eyes are darting around to sort of figure out whether or not it's the carriage you should sit on and how safe you feel if you're on your own. Tiff, thank you. Is that something you would like to see as well, Lauren, that it's not just on the platforms, that it's on the trains as well? And do we even have the personnel for that?
Yeah, I believe that was actually within the media release as well that came out in terms of the deployment of PSOs, is that it enabled more PSOs to be able to go onto the trains as well, not only kind of being stuck at individual stations. So we do kind of see that shift. But we, I don't know, about the kind of spread that you've got, you know, is it on every single carriage? You've kind of in need of other kinds of interventions to be able to help these kind of problems.
Go ahead.
I was going to say this, what was just described by that caller is really not kind of an uncommon experience. It's not an imagined fear. We've got some recent research that came out a couple of weeks ago from Dr. Ramana Sarkar at Monash University that found that one in four women who use trains experience harassment at least monthly. And that increases to about two in four for young women as well.
Do women in particular choose different types of public transport where they feel safer? So trams, there's a driver near you. Bus, there's a driver near you. You can think about where you sit. Trains, I know just personally, anecdotally, you feel a little more exposed. You feel a little more alone, so to speak, and trapped almost. So do women choose different types of public transport?
They do. We do see overall that women use all kinds of public transport more than men across all different modes. We do see that buses play a particularly important role in terms of women's travel, given they often take these kind of trips which are quite different to the trip chains that we see with the way that a man moves around throughout the day. So buses play this real important role, particularly for connecting to kind of our outer suburbs, to our key essential services, to things like childcare. But we also see that the kind of most limited interventions around women's safety are really around buses as well. Some other really great research from Professor Graham Curry at Monash University was around kind of women's biggest concerns in terms of public transport. And one of those is waiting at a public transport,
at a public transport stop.
And that's one of our really big issues.
And some of the bus stops are just, there's nothing, like literally nothing. There might be a sign, but there's certainly no shelter. There's no lights. You're just standing on the side of the road. There's a text here that says, my 16-year-old and her friend got on the wrong train after the Oasis concert and they had to get off at South Kensington, which was deserted. As we raced to pick them up from the station, they stood there with the PSO, thank goodness. So when you start to think about roles like that, whether it be walking to your car, getting on the wrong station, if you're 16 and you're waiting for mum and dad or an older sibling to come and pick you up and you have someone standing beside you, it does put everyone at ease. Hopefully, and just finally, Lauren, are you confident, it's been like over a decade now that we've had PSOs, that this shake-up is a better use of the services of PSOs?
Oh, I think it's a bit tricky. I think that maybe there's a couple of things which have maybe been missed out on, particularly in terms of those perceptions of safety and those invisible roles that PSOs play that haven't really been taken into this decision. So I would really hope that as they maybe do reduce PSOs across those what you just described as a station that was relatively deserted, South Kensington, those kind of stations, which are still so, so important for so many particularly vulnerable women, that we see other interventions start to come in as well. So whether that be, you know, really, really good quality live tracking of when the train, tram or bus is actually going to arrive at the station. We see really good quality lighting as another thing. But the other thing is that we really start to think about how it is we can stop this kind of harassment and and violence happening in the first place. So really educating people around what's appropriate behaviour and what's not, but also how to be a really good bystander if you witness these kind of things.
This message, I wonder whether this is a good idea or not. It simply says, a pink carriage with guard, women only. Do you ever want to see us get to the point, Lauren, where that's a necessity or a good idea?
I don't think so. No, I don't think it's appropriate. I think that we're in a place where we can all function together, and if that's the only way that we can go towards reducing violence instead of just making it not happen in the first place, I think that's pretty sad.
I know. I hate to say it, though. I think I'd probably get on it and use it if it was available. Yeah. Lauren, good to speak with you. Thank you. Dr. Lauren Pearson, thank transport researcher at Monash University. In just a moment, we're going to learn about the first ever day. This is a day to celebrate solo mums by choice. So today is a landmark day. We're going to talk about that. But we've also been speaking about whether or not the cancellation of the Amel and the Sniffers gig and the money on the bar going back to small venues has been a little bit of a blessing in disguise, in that the focus has gone back onto the venues that have created these bands in the first place. Nick Thorpe has called through. Nick, g'day.
G'day, how you going?
Good. Now, you're very connected to the scene, Nick, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm the founder of a charity and a not-for-profit called Live Music Locator. And we have 25 volunteers who every week do research on the gigs that are happening around Melbourne. What happened was, you might recall, there used to be a gig guide that was out there that covered all of the gigs, and we probably all had coffee cups that left stains on those gig guides.
Yeah, I used to work at Beat Magazine, man. I know it very well.
Right. I used to work at a street mag as well. And so, but that all has sort of died out. And now, to get information about venues or artists, you've got to go into those little social media rabbit holes. We did a data study that showed that you would have had to go to 15 or 16 different locations to find all of the gigs in Melbourne in one night. So our vision is to increase foot traffic into small and medium venues. And we have a bunch of volunteers that do that week in, week out. And you can just find that very easily on your phone, what we do.
So it's a Live Music Locator. Is that correct? Is it an app? What's it called?
Locator. Yeah, it's just, you just put seven letters into your phone. It's so easy. Just LML.live. And we work on a sort of a weekly rhythm. So if you go now, you might not see all of the gigs, but by Wednesday or Thursday, you'll have all of the gigs that we cover.
Great. That makes it a lot easier than back in my day when it had to be faxed through from the band manager and then someone had to type it in.
One of those.
Good on you, Nick. It's a great idea. And I love the idea that the spotlight has come back onto small music venues. Coming up in just a moment, today marks the first ever day, a day to celebrate solo mums by choice.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So today is a bit of a landmark day. It actually marks the first ever celebration of solo mothers by choice, which is essentially a day around the world to celebrate solo mums or solo parents by choice and their families. And one of the key focuses of the day is to advocate for equal treatment in law, in policy, and in society. Anna is a solo mum by choice and has joined us in the studio today. Anna, I mean, before we get into some of the concerns and the legalities around this, why is it important to have such a landmark day today celebrating solo mums or solo parents by choice?
Thanks, Rochelle. So solo mums by choice make the intentional choice to create their family. And it's usually by using a sperm donor and IVF or one of those processes, but it also can be through surrogacy or adoption or permanent care. And the reason why we felt it was really important to celebrate is this type of family is booming in Australia. It's the fastest growing family form in the country. And it's not just Australia. It's happening around the world too. And this we sort of see as the next frontier of women's development. Women, we're taking our destiny into our own hands and we are creating our own families. And you might think, okay, well, that's a really lonely path. But in fact, I've found it's the exact opposite. We had a huge picnic yesterday to celebrate with a whole bunch of solo mums and their kids. And what really strikes me is just how much of a community we feel together. I can see some of my friends who have young children as a couple, they really try and battle it out on their own. They might get a bit of help from their grandparents. But solo mums by choice, they just seem more willing to help each other out, to ask for help, to build these kind of non-traditional connections and ways of parenting. So it's just really exciting that we've got to this point in history where this is an option for women and for parents to choose to create their own family.
Absolutely. I mean, I know anecdotally of quite a few women who are either doing it or considering doing it as well. And I think once you've made that decision, you're already a strong woman, right? And you're already someone who has made those choices for yourself. So then to realize, okay, well, if this is one of the fastest growing types of families, then what is the next stage and where are we sort of stuck in the dark ages a little bit? Yes, great, power to you. You're starting your own family. However, if you want to travel, if you want to get a Medicare card, if you want all of the rights that we take for granted, where does it start to get tricky? What have you experienced?
And that's exactly right. As is often the case, the law and how government operates is trailing behind this trailblazing group of largely women that are doing this. So the biggest issue is that the family law doesn't actually mention solo parent families. So already we're not recognised under law, and that's a discrimination in and of itself. But the big risk associated with that is that we're not protected from a sperm donor asserting their legal rights to parenting. And that is when I found out that that was the case. It's very, very scary.
First thing is, I guess, how does it make you feel when you read in paper that you are not recognised as a family?
It's really crushing because it's now such a big industry as well. And I'm a very considered person. I did the research. I went through the mandatory counselling that the Victorian government requires us to do, which, you know, they don't require any other couple that conceive in the bedroom to go through a pre-parenting court.
Yes.
No, don't need to do something like that. But we are made to undertake two implications counselling sessions. And this idea that if we are to then connect with the donor, that they could then assert their rights to be a parent, that was never mentioned. And likewise with the Victorian government, they provide the opportunity for you to connect with your donor and the children of the same donor before you reach the age of 18 where that information becomes available. And there's this disconnect here that no one's
talking about.
So
what's that mean in reality for you? Does that mean not being able to get a passport for your child, or what does it actually mean?
It has a whole, so the parenting risk is huge and very concerning. But in terms of day-to-day reality, think you're a parent, think back to newborn days. You're trying to change nappies, get bottles organised, feed, etc. First of all, you need to prove to birth, deaths and marriages that you are a sole parent, so you need to get additional paperwork. That often means a delay. That means you can't register with Medicare. That means you might need to question, like you might be there going in the middle of the night thinking, oh, I think I need to take my child to the doctor, but they're not registered for Medicare. Am I able to go? What will that mean? What will it cost? And then we get to Centrelink. There's also a delay. And the standard letter Centrelink sends to you says you need to chase your partner for child support. But we don't have a partner. So women are then made to meet with a social worker from Centrelink. So the default assumption is that we're a lesser than as a family form. That's the common thread that runs through all of these things. We need to prove more. We need to justify why we exist. And it causes delays. It means women aren't getting essential income support payments, paid parental leave from the start when they've got their newborns. In my own case with the Department of Foreign Affairs, I wanted to go on a holiday with 48 solo mums by choice, mind you, to Bali, which was amazing. But I had to go to my ex-husband and ask him to sign an additional form to say that my child was not from him, that there was no relation. I'm lucky that, my ex-husband's still my Sparky. We're on good terms. But imagine if a woman was in a situation where her previous partner hadn't been in that relationship, that would prevent her from travel. What if she needed to travel for work? That would prevent her from career opportunities. So it's not just a bit of extra paperwork and just cop it on the chin and suck it up and deal with
it. It's all aspects. Mm. You're listening to Anna, who's a solo mum by choice, one of a growing large group of women or parents who are choosing to become a parent by choice. Today marks the first ever day of celebrating solo mothers by choice. choice. Sarah Jefford, OAM, is a family creation lawyer. Now, that is a type of lawyer that, Sarah, I haven't even heard of, but given that this is such an emerging issue, I'm presuming it's looking at people like Anna and the idea that she isn't recognised as a family and all of the legal implications that come into this. Is this now, I guess, the dedicated area of your practice?
Yes, it is. So I work with a lot of mums just like Anna that are solo mums by choice or queer families that are growing their families with donors. And, yeah, that's a lot of the work that I do is working with single mums that are working with the bureaucracy and the law that doesn't actually recognise their family.
Is it just because the world changed so quickly that they haven't been able to keep up? Is it because they don't respect their family bond? I'm not even going to read out some of the texts that have come in that question, you know, why someone would do it, because I just don't think it's even vaguely relevant. Is it because no one's really just thought about it? What's the reason behind it?
I think it is multifaceted. I'd love to give the government the excuse that they haven't been able to catch up, but the Family Law Act is amended once or twice a year, and still the presumptions of parentage only recognise two-parent families. We just haven't been able to catch up our laws to recognise that there are different ways to make a family and that there's options for having one parent or more than two parents, which is the case for many of the people that I speak to.
So what rights does Anna have, for example, at the moment as it stands, Sarah?
So our federal laws really presume that Anna must have another parent to parent with her, that there's no option to be just a solo parent by choice. So we have presumptions that when somebody conceives a child with a donor that they must be the parent, but that their couple relationship, their spouse, must be the other parent. It kind of leaves this grey hole of, well, what happens if there is no other partner? What does that mean for that child and what does that mean for the parent? And does it actually leave it open for a donor to step in and say, I would like to be a parent to that child, I would like to claim parentage of that child?
So, I mean, Anna, this has made you visibly upset and rightly so, just hearing Sarah verbalise that. And I'm really sorry, I really don't mean to get you upset, because this, you're talking about your family, right? You're talking about your child here, and the fact that our laws don't protect you. Australian Victorian woman, someone who has worked, someone who's paid their taxes, you're currently, your family is currently not protected.
That's right. And it's astounding the process we went through, that I went through with the fertility clinic, being made to do implications counselling, to go through the process with the Victorian government, to go through counselling before I was allowed to want access to the donor register, and for no point in that process for it to be raised, to go to regular medical appointments with fertility specialists. I actually called my fertility specialist after I read the recent article in the Saturday paper and said, did you know this? And she said, oh no, I did a master's module on this. This was never mentioned. I'm like, that's because they're only thinking about couples. Even somebody who is creating family, solo parent families on a day-to-day basis isn't aware of these implications. There's just this real disconnect, and it is...
It's not even when you bury down into the paperwork. If, Sarah, what we're talking about is Medicare, that's sort of at the top. That's one of the first things you have to get organised, and it is a nightmare in those early days when you haven't slept and you're feeding and your boobs are leaking and all sorts of things are going on, and you're in a Medicare office trying to work out paperwork. But this is not something that's buried down the bottom, Sarah. So is that the first thing that needs to change?
Yes, I think so. And I have to say that Anna being upset is not unusual. Unfortunately, I speak to a lot of single mums who have only just discovered that actually their donor could step in and make things very difficult for them, and that there's a lack of clarity around whether he might actually be recognised as a parent for their child. It's deeply upsetting. And then they have to deal with the bureaucracy and explain themselves over and over that there is no other parent. Births, deaths and marriages and Medicare and Centrelink, they default to assuming that every child must have two parents, and the reality is that that's not the case.
What do you expect to happen, Sarah, in terms of, I mean, laws don't get changed quickly, they certainly don't change overnight, but do you expect laws to become a little more contemporary?
I'd like to see that, but, you know, we've had some of these issues for over a decade and they've been talked about for over a decade and they still haven't been tidied up. I think it would be some fairly simple changes to the Family Law Act to close off the presumptions that when somebody has a single mum, that that's the end of it. There is no question mark about whether there's actually a father or another parent involved. But we just provide some clarity around the intention was for a solo mum by choice to have a child as a solo parent, and that that is what we recognise as that family creation and that family unit.
Sarah, it's an incredible line of work that you're in. Did you ever expect yourself to specialise in family creation law?
No, I can't say that I did. I spent a decade as a family divorce lawyer. Family creation law is much nicer, and I work a lot with solo mums and donor arrangements and surrogacy arrangements, and it's amazing. It's often really lovely to speak to people as they plan for the creation of their family, and unfortunately I think our laws and our bureaucracies haven't quite caught up with that.
I feel like we need to get you back in at another time to have a longer chat, Sarah. It's a fascinating Absolutely. World that you work in. Love to. Thank you. Sarah Jeff at OAM is a family creation lawyer. And Anna, look, just to clarify, that experience with Medicare wasn't something that you went through yourself as such, but it's the idea, the prospect of if I needed to go through this, it is so disturbing and upsetting. However, today is the day to celebrate, right? Today is the first ever celebration of Solo Mothers by Choice. You are a part of that group. How will you be celebrating today?
We had a massive picnic yesterday, which was amazing.
In the rain.
In the rain. We were under the oak trees at Botanical Gardens, but it's really connecting online, connecting with the women we know around the world who are solo mums by choice, and really just spreading the word about it is an amazing choice. Yes, there are some paperwork, legal issues that we're dealing with, but it's an amazing community to join, and I'm so appreciative of everyone who supports us.
And this is an emerging world as well. So it's probably in terms of changing laws, getting up to speed. So if people are interested, I'm presuming there will be web pages and Facebook pages that women, men, anyone who is interested or invested in some way can jump on and have a look at Solo Mothers by Choice.
Yes, internationalsmbc.org.
Anna, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Rochelle.
Don't forget the Conversation Hour every day is turned into a podcast. You can go to the ABC Listen app or you can listen back online as well. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Till then, take care. Speak soon.